Hi, this is Danielle from the Jaws Curator, and this is episode 112 of Art for Your Ear. Once again, today's episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. Pop over and see their artsy lineup at saatchiart.com. I am also thrilled to say that episode 112 is co-sponsored by Thrive. Thrive was started by two amazing women in Vancouver, and now the Thrive Mastermind program is available for artists all around the world thanks to their online groups. And I happen to be a member of one of those groups, and it has been a literal life changer for me. Mastermind groups are made up of 10 women per group, and each group meets every month to talk about the ups and downs of being an artist, which there can be a lot of. So if you are looking for this kind of support and accountability, that's the key, head to their website, thriveartstudio.com. Okay, so today's episode is filled with nostalgia, personal stories, and ghost stories. Ooh. Now, I realize we just missed Halloween, but I figure it's close enough. Besides, I love ghost stories, so if an artist has them, I'm putting them in. So, who is this storyteller extraordinaire? American artist Daisy Patton. I have loved her work for ages. I know I always say that, but it is still true. But until now, I didn't really know and understand how much depth and research she puts into each of her pieces. I got chills a few times, and not just from the ghost stories. She happens to be in the middle of a 10-week-long residency, so we're not going to interrupt her for that long. Maybe, well, an hour or so. We are going to talk to Daisy Patton at Anderson Ranch Art Center in Colorado. Here we go. Hi, Daisy.
Hi, Danielle.
First of all, you have such an awesome name.
Thank you so much. I'm actually named after my grandmother.
Oh, I love it even more.
Yeah, well, my whole family is full of flower names. So my sister's name is Lily and my mother's name is Rosemary. So,
I love that. That was my great grandmother's name was Rosa and my grandmother's name was Lillian, but everyone called her Lil. And so, yeah, I had all sorts of flower names as backups in case we had a girl and then we had a boy.
Oh,
yeah. So there's no girl. I couldn't name him, you know, Lily.
No. Although I had some people trying to float Thorin as a potential name. And I was just like, I don't think so.
Oh, my. Rugged.
Yeah.
Do you have kids?
I don't. I have guinea pigs, but I know those don't count.
Well, you can keep Thorin. That's kind of like, it sounds like a newscaster, like Storm Jenkins.
It does. It sounds also like a soap opera name.
Yeah. Yeah, keep that thorn in your back pocket.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to do the thing I always do where we step back in time and talk about little Daisy. But we have to say right now that you're at an artist residency right now.
I am, yes. I'm here at Anderson Ranch, which is in Snowmass Village in Colorado. That's really like a few miles away from Aspen.
Oh, beautiful. Do you have snow yet?
We had snow, maybe like a week or two into the residency. It was Colorado weather is very hectic, I guess. And so I had a t-shirt on in my studio and it was a night that I was working very late. So it was like 1:30 in the morning and I opened the door and there's 4 inches of snow on the ground.
Oh,
my gosh.
Yeah. So surprise.
Colorado. Yeah. Yep, that's exactly what it is.
And so how long are you there for?
So we arrived October 11th, and I will be here until December 21st, I believe.
Wow, that is like a dream.
Yes, it's been really great. So there's different concentrations for residents, and so there's a wonderful little community, and we've all hit the ground running. So it's
been... Oh my gosh, that's so cool. Well, we're going to come back and talk about all of that, but I didn't realize, like I knew that this residency was happening for you in the fall, but I thought maybe you were done or whatever. And then we booked this and you're still there, which is so cool that we get like to hear the news on the ground.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So now we have to rewind the clock. And so, were you artsy when you were little?
Absolutely. I think like many artists, I spent a lot of time drawing and I loved reading. My mom was going to school at LA Community College, and she would bring me to her classes. And one of those was art history. So when I wasn't listening to my Walkman, listening to like Michael Jackson's Bad or The Little Mermaid, which totally dates me, but that's fine.
That's also quite a combo, which, yeah. By the way, I love. Yeah.
Yeah. I was paying attention to the slides and stuff. And then my mom also was very big about taking us to the local museum. So LACMA was a place that was like a favorite space to go to. And even now as an adult, when I get to visit Los Angeles, LACMA holds a special place in my heart. But yeah, I mean, I love drawing. I was really obsessed with dinosaurs. I wanted to be like a paleontologist or an Egyptologist or a farmer because I thought you could hang out with animals.
Yes.
And then also an artist. I think it's one of those things where you think to yourself, you can't make a living as an artist, which is false. But you know, I spent my childhood, early years drawing nonstop in class. I'd have a hard time focusing, so I would sit and do drawings of like Disney characters and animals and things like that.
I wonder, you know, that's so interesting. I wonder where, when that seed gets planted that you can't make a living as an artist.
I think it's fairly young. I feel like there's this sort of idea that these like old masters were either, you know, survived through patronage or they died broke and penniless, which of course, it's such a silly myth of the starving artist. Like that's, I have a new gallery that is very like against that kind of myth. And I know a lot of other artists and yourself, of course, that push this idea that artists can make a living. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, it's just so interesting when you said that, because I was like, yeah, that's what I thought as a kid too. But I was like, who would have told me that, I wonder? But it's just, yeah, it's just a thing that people believe.
Well, I think there's this also this idea that like arts are kind of undervalued in a way, you know, mm-hmm. even though they permeate everything and they make, I mean, I think they make life worth living, you know, for anybody.
Mm-hmm. I know. I always think, imagine what the world would be like if there was no art, like no yeah. writing, no, like no books, no movies, no design, no art. Like what? That's
yeah,
everything.
I mean, that's what we study when we look at different like civilizations and cultures and history. We're studying people's art. Mm-hmm. So it's just such a strange back and forth. I don't know.
Well, we're proving them all wrong. And so what was your mom studying when she was going to school?
She was studying to be a teacher.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I was in Los Angeles until I was 9. And then we moved to Oklahoma. And we're there for 5 years while she was finishing her degree. And then we moved back to California for 2 years, but to Bakersfield, mm-hmm. and then back to Oklahoma again. So I've moved around a lot.
Yeah. And then did you end up settling there or no?
Well, so I went to the University of Oklahoma for my BFA. And then I took the advice that I was given while a student that, you know, take a few years in between undergrad and graduate school to kind of get a sense of who you are as an artist and build up a portfolio. So when I went into my BFA, I actually went in as a double major for history and for art because I thought that you couldn't get a job as an artist. So I thought, well, I'll be a historian.
Sure, because you roll in dough when you're a historian.
Uh-huh. Well, now I know. I'm like, oh, there's like no way that you can get a job in the humanities.
Dollar bills. All the historians out there are like, that's right.
I know, totally. It's the saddest thing ever. I quickly dropped it to a minor because my studio classes were so demanding and I was working full time and I did a year abroad in the UK, which was where I really learned about contemporary art. And then I stayed for 3 years and then I went to Boston to the museum school for my graduate program. But by then I was doing photo.
Wow. Oh, so what were you doing before that? Painting or?
Yes, exactly. Painting. So I was really very much a painter. I had been doing drawing and painting my whole life. But then I got to a painting block that just, it stopped me in my tracks. I couldn't paint anything anymore. And so I had already been taking photo classes. And so I kind of dove into that instead.
Do you know why you could, did you just hit a wall, or do you know why you couldn't paint anymore?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of that. You know, for me, I see painting, I like to say this often, that painting and photography are dysfunctional siblings. Because they're so intertwined with each other. Their histories are so dependent on each other. Photography tried to ape the tropes of painting.
Yeah.
And I can't think of very many painters nowadays that don't use photography as a reference material of some kind.
Mm-hmm, that's a good point.
They're always telling each other they're dead, but, you know.
They have to meet up at Thanksgiving every year, whether they like it or not.
Exactly. And, you know, the paintings that I was doing as an undergrad really sort of set the tone for a lot of my painting vocabulary that I use now. But I was basically cutting out magazine images. When I was a kid, my grandmother would cut out paper dolls from magazines. And so I was kind of doing that as well. But I wasn't putting it directly into the painting itself. I was using it as reference material. And I was kind of compositionally collaging them together. But then, yeah, I think I didn't have the language or the tools conceptually to figure out what it was that I was actually doing. So I had already been taking some photo classes, and I was really interested in documentary and street photography. And so, you know, the interest in history is so much about storytelling. Yeah. And that's where I kind of dropped painting for a little bit. Not forever. I always still saw myself as a painter, just a lapsed painter, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know what I find too? A lot of people go into art school and they go into either painting or drawing because that's what people equate with art school. And then I think sometimes once you get in there and you dip your toe around and suddenly you're like, ooh, the photography lab, or, you know, oh, printmaking press, or, you know, these ceramics, sure, these things that you weren't maybe exposed to before, but then all of a sudden you're like, I'm going to go over there for a bit.
Yeah. I think that most contemporary artists now dive into the various media at some point. This is residency right now. People are doing that. Not me, though.
Just trying different things while they're there, you mean?
Yeah. So yeah. We all have access to the different departments, which is pretty exciting. So there's one of the painting residents is working in printmaking a lot right now. I know that people are hopping back and forth depending on what their interest is. So
that's cool. How many people are there with you right now?
Oh, gosh. I think it's 14 of us.
Wow.
Yes.
See, I keep wanting to go, we're not going to talk about that yet. I'm going to control myself. No, that's me because I'm like, how many people? Then what about this? Okay, no. Okay, so now you're switching over to photography. And
yes.
And so you're having your painting lapse.
Yeah, and you know, my undergraduate was at the University of Oklahoma, so it was actually a state school, and I wanted to go to a school that had a breadth of degree programs and options. So I was in the honors program, which meant that there was an American documentary course that I took that was really fascinating, and where I was introduced to Wisconsin Death Trip, which is an amazing book by Michael Lessie.
Okay.
He made that when he was a grad student, which is just mind-boggling, I guess. but it's really fascinating. So he basically explodes this idea of this like false nostalgia of the past, that things were better by going through the newspaper archives of this small town in Wisconsin from like, I think it was 1890 until 1900. And so he's pulling stories that are only about like death and destruction and mayhem. And interspersing the chapters with the photographs that he's also collecting that the newspaper had published, but without any kind of context. And then he starts collaging them as the book goes through. So there's this kind of rhythm that's happening. And for me, that was a very influential book to kind of...
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, too, the thing for painting is, you know, I spent so much time in my childhood studying art history that I didn't really study as much theory. So when I switched into photo, I did a lot of research into photography theory. Mm. And I think that really has given me language to return back to painting.
Yeah. Well, when you went to do your MFA, what were you focusing on?
So I I went in with photo.
Yeah.
And I left with sound.
You what?
I went in with photo and I left with sound.
Sound. Oh, wow. See, again, you dip your toe in. Who knows what you're going to find in there?
Yeah, well, you know, the museum school is notorious for this. It's a multidisciplinary program. So very often people will come in thinking that they're going to work in one particular medium and they leave with something else entirely. So while I was in grad school, I tried to dip my toes back into painting unsuccessfully at that point. And then had a major life change happen while there. And then my thesis project was a sound installation piece. And it's on children of absent fathers talking about their memories and experiences.
Ooh, that just gave me chills.
Thanks.
And so there was no visuals with it. It was all sound.
Right, exactly. For me, it was very much about the storytelling. And also, it was sort of the start of, you know, I can look back now on my younger self and see that my practice is really focused on sort of voyeurism and issues of power and control. And it sort of switched into this more compassionate, empathic, and somewhat autobiographical practice. So now I sort of organize my whole art making as under the umbrella of history and memory. And
yeah, I love your artist statement.
Thank you.
I'll read that in a moment. Yeah, yeah.
So that big shift happened while I was there. But then I left grad school and I didn't make artwork for a year, which I think is fairly common.
Yeah, you're sort of done.
You know, I think everybody goes through grad school a little bit differently. But from what I have been able to talk to different people from like art grad schools or state schools or anything else, it all is a little bit of psychological trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. I know so many people I've talked to say the same thing. It's just like they just need to do something else. It's hard to be continually prolific. And when you're in school, I was just doing a visiting professorship at the University of Wisconsin last week. And it was, man, those students are busy, you know, and I forgot, like, I was like, oh yeah. Like when you're in art school, it's like, you've got all these different classes and you've got projects and you're pushing yourself constantly to be, you know, I was just doing a fun collage with them, this like workshop, but you could see they're obviously all trying to rock it out, you know? And so, and I forgot, you're like constantly doing that. So after 4 years and then you do your MFA, it's like, yeah, I'm going to not do that for a little bit. So what did you do for that year?
So, you know, the years in between my undergrad and graduate program, I was working university administration. During that time, I was working in the housing office of the school that I graduated from, and I was on the billing and operations side. So contracts and leases, which makes me a very good administrator, which is helpful as a professional artist.
Yeah, no kidding.
After graduate school, so the big life event that happened while I was in grad school is I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Oh my gosh.
Which is not a thing that is exciting to happen in the middle of your grad program.
No, that is not exciting. Oh my God.
But I was very lucky. The school was so accommodating, because when I was first released, like, I was exhausted all the time because I was coming off the steroids, which was the first sort of medication that I was put on to try and get rid of the relapse, which was, or the initial presenting symptoms, which was double vision and blurriness and unsteadiness. So I actually went to school that day and I was like, I'm fine. I'm in Boston, like on the bus, and I'm like, I can't see, but I'm okay.
Oh my, what did you think was happening?
I just thought I was tired. I was like, oh, I just haven't gotten enough sleep and my vision is blurry, and that's what it is. But everybody and I was a TA, and that was the first day of spring semester. And so everybody was like, maybe you should go to a doctor. And I was like, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. I can just use one hand and cover my eye and I can see the board just okay. And they're like, not normal. And then my advisor, who was also the professor, ended up taking me first to the school doctor. I failed the walk in a straight line test. And they're like, well, maybe you should just go to the ER and get yourself checked out. And I was like, oh, whatever, fine. And I did. And they're like, yeah, so we're going to hospitalize you. You either have lupus or MS. We're pretty sure it's MS, though. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go home and I'm going to get my clothes. And they're like, you don't know what hospitalization means.
Oh, my God.
So it took a few months to kind of get my bearings on things. And so that was really sort of the profound shift. I was already sort of feeling like it was time for me to make some kind of change in my practice and started to sort of question what kind of work that I was doing. And then that one just really accelerated that.
Holy cow. How long were you in the hospital?
Just a few days. So my then fiance, now husband, we were doing long distance and he was in Pittsburgh. And so he immediately flew out. And so they got me stable. And then because I couldn't quite get to the hospital, they didn't taper off the steroids. And so I just crashed immediately. I was sleeping like 14 hours a day. And feeling very much like a fish that had been in a fishbowl that had just been like released into the ocean and everything is just too much. But I managed to, you know, slowly, I was still going to class. I was like, I'm not going to take time off. I don't understand that.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you. So you didn't take time off?
No. And so this is where, you know, the school was really accommodating of, you know, I would show up to class and I'd be like, I'm tired. I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, I when I graduated, so this was before the ACA in the U.S. I was in Massachusetts, so I was required to have health insurance, and whew, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But it didn't have standards of care, so, like, my pharmacy payout for the whole year was $1,000, and my first medication was $2,500 a month. So whoa. I had to depend on the charity of a drug company until the ACA was put in. So that's why I ended up working university administration again after graduate school, because I didn't have the ability to hustle together a bunch of jobs or do teaching fellowships because I needed to have insurance.
Wow. Okay, so when you're first diagnosed, did you have to like Google MS? Does anybody in your family have, like, did you even know what that meant?
So one of our visiting artists that came like maybe the semester before, had MS. And I remember that she was very sort of fragile. And I knew about like Annette Funicello.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid, we watched a lot of like old TV and stuff. So like Judy Garland, musicals and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I had a general idea. Nobody has it in my family, but there's a lot of autoimmune diseases. And so MS is an autoimmune disease. So it's not quite surprising on that regard. But there's still a lot of unknowns about the illness. And it's a very individual disease. So some people have a really terrible, severe progress. And then, you know, I've had it for 7 years, almost eight. Going to be eight in January.
Wow.
And I've been fortunate to not have too much of a change.
Yeah. Okay. Cause you can keep it quite stable, right? If you're careful with things and,
well,
is that right?
The medication is pretty helpful for that. So yeah. I'm on a new medication that basically pauses the illness, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the U.S. right now with the healthcare stuff, like it's very stressful. We're
yeah.
Just gonna go.
And that stress is not good for you, right?
No, not
no.
really.
I have a friend that has it and she has two kids. Mm-hmm. And she was told to probably not have kids.
Mm.
And she said, I don't care. So they had one and they thought, and I think they even had to do IVF for it. And, but she really yeah. just didn't want to go through life without children. So she had one and, took a toll on her body and everything, but she was like, but I've got my child. And then she got pregnant by accident, like pregnant on her own.
Oh no.
And was like, what? And so had another one, but she's doing really well. Like she's adjusted her life in a way that she has a lot of help. She's got family around. She really takes care of herself, you know, she does the medication and everything. So she's the only person I know, you know, that I've seen anything of.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I was like, if I was diagnosed, I'd have to Google it.
Yeah, I only barely knew about it. Like, yeah. And Google is like if you have any worst. Kind of medical condition, you automatically think you're going to die if you Google it.
I know, that's true. I brought a headache. Oh boy. It's a tumor. Yeah.
I showed up to my first neurology appointment and I had a neurologist that I did not care for. Okay. He was one of those very arrogant male doctors. And I was like, okay, I have a list of questions. You know, I had only a little notepad ready. And he was just like, oh, I'm not going to talk to you about this.
Really?
Well, just, you know, I was like, okay, well, I saw some people on these forums that talked about diet. And he's like, that's not a thing. And I was like, okay, well, I'm a vegetarian. He's like, do you eat fish? I was like, no, I don't eat fish because I'm a vegetarian.
Right.
It's like, I'm not going to eat fish. So he's like, well, they need to be on fish oil pills. And I was like, oh. But then a study came out that showed that those are kind of useless. And I was like, ha, I'm getting off this.
There you go. Oh my God, that's crazy. So how are you, like, well, I guess you just kept plodding along. Like, you kept going to class and did your thing. And so was the sound installation a result of all of this happening?
It was a result of that sort of shift in focus and things that I was interested in. The photography work that I was doing, you know, was street and documentary work, but it was also very predatory. Because I would go out in public and I would take pictures of people without their permission. Sometimes I would block sidewalks and make them walk around me and then photograph them. And so that's hard to do when energy levels are a little unstable, and especially that first year it's kind of a rough, you're kind of getting used to that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of felt like I couldn't quite shoot the way that I was shooting before. And that's when I started diving into some more autobiographical things. I grew up without my father. I don't know who he is. I know that he's Iranian and that he has red hair and green eyes. And so that I had never cared to know anything about my father. And I was, 27 and a half exactly when I started having the MS symptoms. And so that's the age that my mom was when she had me. And so I felt like it was a fortuitous time to start sort of exploring that background a little bit.
Mm. Did you look for him or no?
Kind of, you know, I've never been interested in actually meeting him, because I feel like there's only one way that things could go well and the rest are all very terrible.
Right. Yeah.
But I would like to know more about my family history and the people that I'm related to and that sort of thing. And also this sort of idea of creating these like alternate timelines or realities where he did exist and was present and what those things sort of mean. And I had grown up with so many people that didn't have a father. And so that's where I sort of was like, I'd been doing research around trying to locate him or trying to recreate or reenact certain things. And was told it wasn't art.
Oh.
Art grad school.
Oh no. Mm.
Yeah. But then I sort of was like, you know, I started to dabble in sound. First, I was recording myself telling ghost stories that had happened to me when I was a kid.
Ooh, like actual ghost stories?
Yes.
Ooh, I love ghost stories. Okay, we're coming back to that. Okay, go on.
I've always been obsessed with it.
Me too.
Well, I think that history is like a series of ghosts that keep haunting us until we learn from history.
Yeah.
But that's like another sort of thing.
Well, it's very much like that book you were talking about.
Yes, exactly. So I sort of tested out this sort of sound installation where I was recreating and recording myself talking about these stories and also thinking about things that happened in my past and things that happened to my mother and sort of seeing them in the context of ghost stories or in sort of the language of ghost stories. Mm. And then, you know, as it was thesis year time and I was already thinking about what that would look like. And I thought, you know, maybe sometimes autobiographical work can be a little too close. And yes. I like to have barriers, protective barriers, perhaps. And so, you know, I thought it would be more interesting to sort of get at this autobiography with other people. So I started interviewing people that I knew. I also put out requests and had like complete strangers come and be so gracious to share their lives and stories with me. And so that was my thesis project. And the title of that series is called I'm Perfectly Fine Without You. That came from actually one of the interviews. And it's still an ongoing body of work. You can download it for free from iTunes as a podcast. And I have a few interviews that are sitting on my laptop that I should be eventually processing.
That's where you're going to be sitting right now for the next few days. And did you ask, so were all these people that you talked to, is the common theme that they didn't grow up with a father or what is the?
Yes, exactly. Okay. So that he was missing in childhood, which is, you know, sort of the formative years. But that range is so broad. There were some people who were like me and had never met their father. There were other people whose parents got divorced when they were very young, and it was a contentious divorce, and they didn't want to be around their fathers, or their fathers were abusive or alcoholics. One of the recent ones, I think, is actually where one of the fathers was imprisoned and then died.
Oh, my word.
So some of them are very intense. And then some of them are, you can tell that there are certain people who have kind of come to terms with this absence. And then there are others where they're still sort of trying to deal with this trauma. So I had to do a lot of research into trauma as well. And I had to sort of quickly formulate how I was asking questions because I realized that, you know, if you ask someone a question, they feel sort of obligated to answer it. And to give them the agency of saying, hey, if you don't want to answer this question, that's okay. Like, we don't have to talk about this. Mm. And so I had some people that actually mentioned that it was almost like a therapy session in a way. But it also meant that they were, I feel this like tremendous responsibility to them. Even though they're all anonymous and I take out any sort of identifying details, like names, it's still a lot. It was a delight.
Yeah, that is super heavy. But I mean, it must have felt like therapy for you too, to know that there were other people, you know, that had these same questions as you.
Sort of, you know, like as a younger person, I spent a lot of time like reading advice columns.
So did my husband. He loves those.
I mean, they're great. But it's also like, how do you be a person in the world? What's like normal, or, you know, what is normal? Like, there's no such thing as normal. No. And so like, I think that's also why people love reading advice columns. Cause you're like, oh, I would never do that.
Yeah, that's right. Compared to them, I'm super normal.
Exactly.
So you're still doing those.
I am here and there. It's one of those things where if someone approaches me, I'll do one.
Okay.
I have evidently separation issues because I have multiple bodies of work that are ongoing at the same time.
No, that just means you're prolific. That's okay. just say it like that.
Well, you know, I think there's something about like with painting, you're not really dependent on another person per se.
Right.
My work is slightly different in that I do in terms of setting them up, but in terms of actually painting them and sourcing material, like that's on me. But I have a lot of...
Let's talk about your stuff that you do. Like everything that I've seen of yours is very much like it's Larry and nostalgia and sort of, is it photo and painting mixed together or is it just a painting that looks like a photo?
Yes. So that body of work is...
Yes. We'll just say yes.
It's called Forgetting Is So Long, and it's where I take abandoned family photographs that I find all over the place, eBay, thrift stores, antique shops. I get gifted them now sometimes. Mm-hmm. I scan and enlarge them to life size, print them out, and then mount the print to panel and then paint over the print with oil paint.
Okay, see, now that's what I did not that's kind of what I guess I had no idea how big they were. I was snooping around on Instagram the other day and I was like, these are huge.
Yeah.
And I never knew that. I never realized that. And then, okay. So then that was one of my questions. So they're not your family.
Right, exactly. They're other people's families.
And have you ever done it with your own family?
Well, so the project actually started that way, sort of. So after grad school, worked for a year doing university administration again. It was the best job I've ever had, and therefore, you know, I can never work again.
Yeah,
in an office job situation. And then my husband got into a PhD program at the University of Colorado in Boulder, which meant that we had to leave Boston. And I was having a really tough time finding a job out there. And also the pay was terrible. And I was like, I just spent so much money on my graduate degree to like go back to doing what I did before grad school is depressing. And so we took my husband was very supportive and encouraging as he always is. And we took the financial hit and I started doing art full time.
Wow.
So I knew that I couldn't do an interview for the sound project because, well, you know what you're going to ask yourself, and it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. So I instead started doing these small paintings on panel. And it was the first time I had painted on panel. And these were strictly oil paintings. And the series is called A Reconstructed Family Reunion. Mm-hmm. And I found this guy on Facebook that I thought might be my father. I now don't think he is. And I started merging our family photographs together. So I was painting us together, sort of imagining this alternate reality where he did exist and was present in my life. Mm. And what that would kind of look like. But I will paint photorealism, but I don't enjoy painting.
Yeah, I hear that. I can't even do it, let alone enjoy it.
It is... I know a lot of artists love doing it, but for me, it's very tedious in a very particular way. But you know where you're going. You know what it needs to look like.
Right.
So I had been painting those, and I had my grandmother's photographs. And like I said, I'm named after her.
Mm-hmm.
And they're amazing. They're gorgeous. And they're so evocative. And I wanted to figure out how to translate that into painting. So I tried to use them as photo references to make strictly oil paintings, and I couldn't even finish one. it was just a colossal failure, which is fine. I find failure to be very important in artistic process. So,
yeah.
And I'm very comfortable with that. So if something's not working, I'm like, all right, well, something else has to happen.
Yeah.
So I was in this like boutique-y kind of shop and I saw this like stack of family photographs and I was like, oh, and I went and I picked up some of my favorite ones that were sort of calling to me. And I went online and figured out I went on this like conservator's website that is no longer in existence, which is such a bummer. It was so good. It was a little snobby because, like, they would just chide you if you did something wrong, but conservators. But I figured out how to mount a print to panel. And, of course, you know, I had that photo background. And so I put the photograph onto the panel itself, and I started painting without any sort of, like, It was subconscious painting. I didn't have a, this is what this project is going to be. This is what this series is going to be about.
Was it the original photographs that you were using, or had you copied them?
I had scanned and enlarged them.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. And it was like magic. It just immediately worked. And so I was like, okay.
Yeah.
As I started painting them, then I started realizing what were some of the themes that I was sort of exploring and working with, and that's where the artist statement sort of came afterwards.
Okay. I'm going to read that right now then. Okay.
Yes.
I wrote down, this is the chunk that I really like. Oh man, I can't see. Hang on. Now you're going to hear my papers. Okay. Here we go. It was in a shadow. I like this part. Adventure and detective tales, history and art history books and ghost stories. Oh, this is in the third person, but Patton's practice is focused on history, memory, and social commentary stemming from this youth soaked in such specific cultural landscapes. Her work explores the meaning and social conventions of families, little discussed or hidden histories, and what it is to be a person living in our contemporary world. Ooh, I just love it all. See, okay, so this is what I wanted to know, because I used to work with, like, years ago, family photos, mainly of my grandmother and my mom, and, but it was almost like they were too personal, and once that work was made, I don't know, I just felt so exposed. It was very vulnerable. I just felt like putting out, like, I don't know, maybe I was so afraid of criticism or something. And I was like, don't insult my Grammy. You know, I don't know what it was. It was just like, it just felt like it's her. She's gone now, you know, and I miss her so much. And we were very, very connected. Speaking of ghost stories, and I've had a lot of weird things happen with her since she passed. And so then that, which is why I was making these pieces. And then, I don't know, it just felt weird and wrong. And so now I just use found imagery, like from old books and stuff. And but it's funny because I incorporate Queen Elizabeth into a lot of my work.
Yes, they're hilarious and wonderful.
I know, it's so funny because she reminds me so much of my grandmother.
Oh, so she's like a symbol or like
she's like a bit of a stand-in for my grandmother. And which I'm sure my grandmother would be horrified to hear.
Because I don't know. I'd be excited. I'd be like, yeah, I'm a queen.
I'm a queen. That's right. But she was a very much a free spirit. I don't, maybe Liz is a free spirit too. She's just not allowed to be. I don't, that's my hope and dream for her. Yeah.
I've seen some photographs where she's shooting a machine gun. She looks pretty free spirited to me.
I know. And I always love the photos of her with camera. She always had a camera or a video camera. Like, I always think that if she hadn't been born into royalty, maybe she would have been an artist. With a machine gun. I don't know. But anyway, so I have this whole, like, pretend story of her in my mind. And, but when my grandmother was older, she, you know, they set their hair the same way. And, like, there was just a lot of similarities. And, like, women of that age, like, you know, like, the kind of fashion, like, she had those purses. She wore those kinds of coats. And so that's my little nod to her now without it being her. And so I was so curious with yours, especially with all of this, you know, finding your dad and all of these things. Did you ever find that when you were using personal photos, did it feel too personal? Like, why did you switch to using people you don't know?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's something so specific about your own personal history that can sometimes be difficult to access for other people. And you know, not that there's anything wrong with that, but also that it just, I don't like being psychoanalyzed through my artwork. I had that happen when I was an exchange student in England. I had the psych major come in and looked at my really surreal and kind of awful, I'm not going to lie, they were terrible things. They were very, like, grotesque in a lot of ways. And, psychoanalyzed me from that, and I was like, nope, never gonna do that again.
See, that's what I mean, like, you're so exposed. And I think I've been talking to a lot of artists lately about code, like having like a visual code. I'm working on a new book right now about women artists, and I just finished the chapter about narrative. I know, I'm so excited about narrative painting. Yes. And I profile three different women who do narrative style painting, but very differently, and all of them have these like secret codes, you know, where like snowmen mean this, and you know, like a pop can means this, and so they can weave their own personal stories in without being psychoanalyzed.
Yeah, I, you know, for me, the thing that's kind of freeing about the Forgetting Is So Long series is that I have my own personal interpretations of the pieces themselves, and I have certain ways that I am responding to the original photograph, but I think that the audience reaction is actually far more valid and more important. So I don't like to tell people very often what certain ones are about or why I'm doing certain things, because I have noticed that people will approach the paintings and they will sort of see them as ciphers for their own memories and histories and start to interpret them and be like, oh, well, that reminds me of so-and-so in my family.
Or that's the great thing about those old found photographs is like they'll always remind you of your own family photographs. Like there's like a shared, there's like a shared history with those, that where it doesn't have, you know, your exact grandmother or your exact whatever, but it's kind of everybody's grandmother or, you know, that moment at this time. And it triggers stories in you, whether you want to or not.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I love that. I don't know if I've ever told this story on the podcast, but I was just telling somebody in Wisconsin that when I was in my last year of my painting degree, I'd put up a painting for a crit, and somebody, you know, the first person said, "Well, what does it mean?" And there was 24 students in the class, and I said, "Well, I wanted everybody to go around and each person tell me what they thought it meant." So they did. Everybody went around and said their thing, and then they said, "Well, who's right?" And I said, "Well, you're all right, because that's the point, right? Is that it will evoke something different in every single person." And I got a C because I did. Yeah, because I didn't have like my own concrete, like, I know. Oh, I hated art school. Anywho, but I just always thought that was so interesting because, yeah, that, you know, it's much more interesting for a viewer to come up and get, you know, have a physical or emotional reaction to something, whether it's what you intended or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, for me in my bodies of work, I think access points, not everybody is grown up with art and they may not understand art. And I want to be accessible mm-hmm. to a range of audiences and not just one particular one. And so everybody has a family photograph. They know what that means to them and they can kind of extrapolate from there. Mm-hmm. And I've had some people that I had one person come up to me and they were like, "These are really funny." And I was like, "Okay." And then I don't know. She was laughing and it was very strange. I did not want to continue that
conversation. Right. We're like, "Let's just leave it at that. Thanks for coming. Bye bye."
But then I had some work up for a show, and the gallerist told me that this woman like sat transfixed in front of the painting and then rushed off to the back of the gallery. And so he went to go check on her and she was crying. And she said that she couldn't explain why she was crying, but that the painting made her cry. And I was like, I mean, you know, as on the one hand, you're like, "Oh, that's really sad." But on the other hand, as an artist, you're like, "Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I broke her. Nice."
Yeah. Well, maybe not broke, but like, you know, that created a reaction that's
amazing.
That it's kind of like, yes, thank goodness. Like, you know, you don't want to make art that people just look at and are like, "Okay, whatever."
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering if the lady, maybe she was just an odd bird, but the one that thought it was funny, maybe it was like your colors or, you know, because your colors are very lively and vibrant and, you know, maybe it was that triggered like joy or something. Or maybe she was just crazy. Yeah. I don't know. but I have to say, because I'm not sure the last time I wrote about you was probably like a year or two ago. But the forgetting is so long, like you are on fire. Like I was just going through all of that and I was just like, "Oh my God, I love that. I love that. I love that. I love that." Like it's, I already thought you were great a couple of years ago, but it's just everything has gotten, I don't know, richer, more. Like, what's going on? More detail? What's happening?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a couple of things. And thank you so much for all those lovely words. I think that, you know, initially in the series, I was really focused on the history of portraiture and was working a little bit smaller. So, you know, 24 by 18, 30 by 40. And I hadn't really set the rules in place yet that I wanted the images to be life size. And actually my first sort of foray into like a class photo, I had it on a 30 by 40 panels and it was a colossal failure. And I realized that they needed to be life size. They needed to be bigger. So I think starting to delve into candids where it's like a full scene instead of just these smaller portraits, I think was one really big leap for me. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of logistical challenges of trying to figure out how to get a print that size onto a panel that size.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, I'll hit that one on the next.
Okay.
But the other thing too is that patterns started to emerge as another visual language tool. So part of the series for me, I'm thinking about this anthropologist named Michael Tosic, who talks about defacement. Specifically, the thing that I'm referencing from him is the defacement of sacred objects and how it sort of shocks them back into being. Mm. So the story that I like to say that to make it a little bit like more it is basically like, you know, if you're in a public park, you don't really notice statues or monuments until they're vandalized, and then suddenly they're present again and you notice them. So thinking about family photographs that have been discarded and ignored, and painting them, sort of interrupting them. You know, for me, defacement is not this act of violence, but rather this tool of remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
So pattern has sort of emerged as another way of like demonstrating relationship or organizing the composition. I'm referencing a lot of historical wallpaper design, but then also my own floral patterns that I'm slowly like digging into. It's really funny because like I hated all this stuff as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
I hated antique shops. My mom dragged me all the time. I hated antique shops. I hated florals. I hated all of that stuff. And now I'm working in all of it.
I know, because it's like it plants a little seed in your heart somewhere. Like, when you talk about that, I can, like, smell my grandmother's house.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Like, the wallpaper and all of that stuff and the textures and yeah, all the things that I thought were tacky.
Yeah.
That well, now you know, I'd give anything to walk into that house, you know?
Oh. Well, I have a book that is a set of wallpaper patterns. It's a historical book, but it's also about how wallpaper had arsenic in it. And so there's this like sort of push pull between this like deadly, but also really decorative and beautiful.
Really?
Yeah.
Like what, it was part of the glue or something?
Or the pigments. It's I saw it reviewed on Hyperallergic and I was like, I need this book. So some of my patterns come from that book. But also I'm doing like research, trying to dig through other patterns. I'm trying to also be very particular about what kind of patterns I'm sourcing and being not being culturally appropriative.
Mm-hmm.
But then also when I was a kid, you know, I didn't grow up with my father and I didn't grow up with that culture. But my mom gave me a book about Persian drawing and painting. And so much of it is so pattern heavy that mm-hmm. now as an adult, I was at this like Middle Eastern photo show that was incredibly pattern heavy. And I went, oh, duh.
Yeah.
Of course. So
that's really interesting. That's so cool. It's just so rich. Maybe that's why this new work just seems so rich and thoughtful. And I love that it's huge. I would love to see it in person. Online is so great in that you get to, you know, see people's work from all over the world, but like there's nothing like standing in front of it.
Well, if you ever visit Seattle, I'm moving there next year.
You are?
Yes. So right now I'm doing long distance round 2 with my husband because he's in Seattle right now for a postdoc. So that's 2 to 3 year thing. So I will be joining him late in the spring for a variety of reasons. In terms of the delay, not in terms of joining him, because obviously.
Yes.
But I kind of like him.
Yeah. Sounds like a pretty good guy.
So hopefully I would, because you're in Vancouver, right?
Well, I was in Vancouver. I'm a few hours outside of Vancouver now, but we actually go to Seattle quite a bit. So for sure. Yes. And bring your wallpaper book and let's go for coffee and talk about, and let's tell ghost stories.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, actually, okay. I'm going to work that into the not so speedy speed round.
Okay.
because I need to know. Okay. So before we do the not so speedy speed round, and you don't have to give away your secrets, but how on earth do you get a giant print like that onto a giant panel like that? Do you need assistance?
I do. It is such an ordeal.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So I use gel medium to adhere the print, the back of the print to the panel. So first of all, the prints that I'm using are, of course, inkjet paper, which means it's a fast dry paper. I live in Colorado, which is devoid of any kind of humidity.
Ah.
And so there's a lot of logistical challenges of going large. I was noticing that there was like wrinkling that was happening. And so I finally figured out how to get everything to work where it's a pretty clean mount. I do have a crew of people that I'll call up. My husband was my main studio assistant. now we're doing long distance. And so my new gallerist, who's absolutely delightful, his name's Doug Cassina. I have trained him to do it. And then I need three other people when I mount one of these panels. One person doesn't have to stay very long. They just have to stay long enough to hold up a corner until I get the whole piece flat. And it's a 48-hour process. So the first 24 hours, they're weighted down. The second 24, they're stood up while they're drying. And there's so many variables. And despite the fact that I've done it so much, there's always going to be some kind of like shift or change or something. And
Do you have to scrap them or can you work with it?
No, thankfully I've never had that happen yet. Knock on wood.
Yeah, I shouldn't have even brought it up. Sorry.
Well, because they're so big and they cost so much money. And, you know, like I have the failed paintings and people are like, well, can't you paint over them? And I'm like, nope, I can't. You can't just like start from scratch. I would have to sand everything down and try and from that. So I keep trying to figure out other ways of doing this, or at least sourcing it out, because it's so time consuming. It's so energy consuming. But I haven't gotten to that point yet.
Maybe in Seattle, maybe there'll be a studio in Seattle that will say, just send it to us.
Yeah.
We'll make it for you and ship it back to your studio.
Yeah.
We'll put it out into the universe. Because, I can't even imagine.
I'm about to do really big ones coming up for a show, and I don't know how they're going to work.
You're doing right now at the residency?
Well, here at the residency, I'm working on three bodies of work at the same time, and I have been incredibly prolific here. There's something about being in this space. We're fed every day, which is also helpful. Mm-hmm. And no commute. So like I finished three paintings that would normally take me 2 months to do, which is wonderful.
That's awesome. That's what I was like when I went to Wisconsin, because I taught in the mornings, but then I had my own studio in the afternoon. I have a studio in my house, but I also have a kid and two dogs and have to make dinner and I have to, you know, do Jealous Curator stuff and write a book and, you know, stuff. And there I just made art, and they, same thing. They brought me food and I was just this is crazy. And same thing. I got so much done. I haven't done anything since I've been back. So use all your minutes.
I know. Well, you know, I thought that I always try to overdo everything, just in case. Cause I like to overplan things. And so I was like, I definitely have enough work. And now I'm like, oh crap. So my gallerist is going to run up some small little pieces for me. I do some small, just to have like a range of prices. I'll do some 8x10s. Okay. They also are a great way of like experimenting and then using excess paint. So
right. And so when is the big show that you're getting ready for?
I have a few of them next year. So let's see here. The first one chronologically is going to be, I have a series about women who died because abortion was illegal.
Whoa.
And so, yes, part of that was influenced by this last election in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And also that reproductive rights have been sort of a newer thing that's emerged from my practice. So I have two bodies of work on that. One is on abortion and one is on forced sterilization. So two sides of the same coin of reproductive oppression. And I'm working on those two bodies of work here at Anderson Ranch as well. So I'll have a show of the abortion paintings, and those are photorealistic paintings. So like I said, it's one of those things that's like, I'm doing it because I need to do it, but also I don't enjoy it in the same way. And the 100% of the proceeds of those paintings will go to reproductive justice organizations. So that is in July, and that's in Denver at a place called the Art Gym. And then I am doing two shows that are overlapping with each other, which is why I'm a little like, I need to make a lot of work right now.
Yeah.
One is my solo with K Contemporary, which is located in Denver in downtown. I will be doing a garden theme show. So some of the work that I've been posting recently, those three paintings, those are all for that.
Okay. And when is that?
That is October of 2018.
Okay.
And then the other show, I was invited by curator Sandra Furman to do a show at the CU, University of Colorado in Boulder Art Museum. And that will be late summer, early, I think the dates are like late July, early August until about the third week of October, if I remember correctly.
Wow. So they're all, everything is bumping up together.
That show is going to be about funeral photographs, which is a thing that I find very fascinating. And I'm so delighted to be asked to be doing this show because it means that I get to work on them. So the paintings that I'll be doing for that are everything from funerary floral arrangements that incorporate the photographs of the deceased to the studio portraits that are done. It's sort of your last portrait before you're buried.
Oh my God.
There's a whole like genre of this. And I find them so fascinating just from like the photo history perspective, this idea of your last portrait, the death upon death. But then also, you know, the sort of idea, you know, the way that we look at death now is very similar to how Victorians looked at sex. And so there's this, it's like this taboo thing. When I tell people I've been working with funeral photographs, they're like, oh. My own husband's that way too. He is very death averse and I'm incredibly morbid. So every time I'm like, hey, look at this one, he's just like, can we not do this?
That's so funny. But you know what? It's kind of like, it made me think of when you were talking about, you know, like the statues and defacing them to kind of give them life again. It's sort of the same thing, right? It's like this weird resurrection by like taking these old funeral portraits and you're resurrecting them almost.
Yes. I think they're so fascinating. Just from so many different, you know, and also I think about like vernacular photography, family photography, and them sort of showing these rituals of our lives, and death is part of that.
Yeah.
Even if we don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, it's coming. Yeah.
Yeah. We're all going to die.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Wow. That, I can't wait. Have you posted any of that work yet or no?
I did one painting before I came up here that I was supposed to have worked on here, but I couldn't stop myself. And so that is a floral arrangement. And there's this like, I think, stupid looking dove that's been taxidermied and put on top of it. You know, there's all this like visual language that, and symbolic language that's part of funerals and funeral, all of these photographs. So like, you know, a dove that's pointing upward means that the soul is ascending to heaven, and pointing downwards means something else. And there's anchors and all of these other, like, you know, the wreaths are these circles. So that's meant to like represent eternity. And, so there's all this like symbolic language that's embedded in this, that I've been doing some research, light research on.
Wow.
Very fascinating. So I will be working on one of the funerary floral arrangements while up here. So in this case, not all of them have people in them. Some of them are just florals, which is kind of different for me and also kind of a new logistical challenge. So
yeah, are you enjoying
it?
We'll
see. Gotten to it yet.
Yeah, okay.
We'll see.
Okay, fair enough. Oh my gosh, I love how much you research things.
Oh,
I'm going to go through the episode and count how many times you said research.
Oh, no.
I love that. Because it's like a rabbit hole, right? You can just get lost. You can just get lost with these things.
It is. And it's also sometimes a very frustrating rabbit hole. So like right now I'm doing the abortion paintings, trying to find these women and then trying to find their names, a photograph and a general description, and also like a sense of who they were as people, is so tremendously difficult. And so there's somewhere like they're very famous. They were in so many newspaper stories, but there's not like a photograph or there's not a description of who they were as people. It's their relationship to men or to other family members. And that value, you know, you don't hear their voice at all. So for me, research is both this thing that I really enjoy digging into, and I think that's where I thought I was going to be a historian.
Right.
But then also it can be very frustrating because it's like, why here.
Yeah. I clicked on this. I want it now. I'm finding that even with this this book about women artists, because I'm featuring 45 contemporary artists, but then I'm sprinkling in sort of little did you knows about historical women. And very often, yeah, they're connected to, like, they might have been an amazing artist, but what they're famous for is, you know, they slept with so-and-so, or they were the muse of so-and-so. But then it's like, but then if you actually go and look at her work, it was amazing, but she was a woman and she was sleeping with somebody. And so, you know, she didn't really count. And I get mad and I'm like working away and I'm just like fuming about this stuff. And it's just like, oh, somebody should write a book about this. And it's like, oh, I'll do it. But I feel the same thing. And sometimes you just, I just, it's like ramming my head into a wall. Like sometimes I just can't find the information that I want. And so I've had to like abandon certain stories and go and find other people because I just can't get the info I need.
Yeah.
Super frustrating.
Or you'll start getting a little bit of one person and then there will be a lead opening for another person. And you're like, oh, I'm going to go chase after this one. And so it is. It's this rabbit hole that you just keep tumbling down.
12 hours passes and you realize you haven't eaten anything.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of which, it's getting close to your supper time. So let's do the not so speedy speed round. Yeah. And then I will let you go back to your residency. That's the other thing. I couldn't believe that you were taking an hour out to talk to me when you've got this like precious time.
How could I not want to talk to you?
I love this. So excited to do the post. Like, what a good excuse to like put all this stuff in. Okay.
Yes.
Ready? Here we go. Favorite color?
I don't have one. I love all of them.
I knew you were going to say that. All right.
I love the ugly colors. I actually will try really hard not to work with really beautiful colors because it's too easy. I love those muddy mustards and dirty looking shades, but I tend to be pretty bright. So
you add a little pop of something pretty and it makes mustard and cranberry work somehow.
Yes.
I was just working with an art consultant because I'm trying to be a real artist now. And she was saying, pardon?
You are a real artist.
I know, but I'm owning it finally. So there you go. My name is Danielle and I'm an artist. And so I actually let an art consultant into my house to help me sort of figure out what I'm doing and where I'm going. And her name is Penny Lane Shen and she's amazing. So everybody should phone her because she will totally change your life. Little plug. So anyway, she had said about my work, she's like, you're obviously a graphic designer, which I was for 18 years, because she said, all of your work is very pretty. And she said, I want to challenge you to make some ugly stuff. Like, try using some colors that you really hate. And I was just like, So I was doing that when I was in Wisconsin and it was uncomfortable, but I'm going to like, there's something like it's true, right? So I'm going to keep trying.
You know, I hated pink for the longest time because of all the gender connotations.
Yeah.
But now it's one of my favorite shades. I use so much pink and it's because it's such a versatile color and it can mean so many different things. And you can get this like dirty looking pink and it's just,
I hear you. I have to have pink. That's my grandmother color. I have to have her. I have to have it in there. But yellow. Ooh, I really hate yellow. So I'm going to try and embrace some yellow ochre. Ooh.
I love yellow so much.
I hate it. Okay. I will try and put it in there. Okay. What is your go-to birthday cake flavor?
Oh, that's such a sad thing to ask now. because I am now a dairy-free vegetarian. And
the
thing in the world to eat was like the Baskin-Robbins ice cream cake. So there were years where as an adult, I finally got to eat them again. And I was really, I would even do a little dance to go.
A little song and dance. Oh my God. What was your Baskin Robbins ice cream flavor cake you liked?
Oh my gosh. So vanilla cake with, Cherry's Jubilee.
Oh, I used to always get the Jamocha almond fudge.
Oh,
that
was
my cake for the longest time from Baskin Robbins. Jamocha fudge.
Oh, they're so good. And they have that commercial with the little ice cream and cake. So that's what I would do.
Is that what your dance goes to? That's the song. That could be the soundtrack to your little dance. Okay, so well, now what do you do for birthdays?
Well, I also really love and obsessed with donuts. So sometimes I'll have donuts for my cake. Mm-hmm. There's Voodoo in Denver now, and so they have vegan donuts. And there was one year where I had two of the Texas Challenges, which are these giant glazed donuts, stacked on top of each other, and that was my cake. I did not share that with anybody.
That is awesome. Last year for mine, I got three honey crullers. Is that a Canadian thing, or is that like just a donut thing?
I have not heard of honey crullers. I've heard of just crullers.
Well, they're kind of just coated in like a sugary shell. But anyway, they don't taste like honey, but I don't know why they're called that. Okay, so crullers, and I stacked three of them, and then I sprayed whipped cream in the middle. Psht, and I might have put a layer of Nutella in between each one.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
That actually makes my hands hurt. I have really bad arthritis, and sugar really makes my hands hurt. That actually makes my hands hurt just talking about it.
Oh, no.
So good.
I really hope that I know some people, and also I probably shouldn't be eating so much sugar. Oh, it's so good.
I know. When it's your birthday, it's fine. Just not every day. Okay. Mm-hmm. One final question, and then I have to ask your best ghost story. So final speed round question. Karaoke? Hell yes or hell no?
Oh, no. I enjoy going to watch other people perform karaoke and like heckle them from my seat because I'm an awful person, evidently. There was this one, we lived in Boulder for 2 years and we did not like it because we are city people and that was not our place. But there was this one dive bar called the Outback Saloon and they would have karaoke on the weekends. And I loved it so much because they were so terrible. There was one person and some of it was deliberate terrible. So like there was this one woman that sang Bailamos. It was the best thing in the universe. I just wanted to like hug her afterwards.
But you never went up.
You know, so I'm a very earnest person and I love earnest things, except for karaoke. I cannot do it. Like my snark comes out for that one and that alone. So no, I don't.
Oh my God. That's funny. I love it. Okay. Do you have a good ghost story for me?
Ooh. Do you want it to be something that happened to me?
Yes.
Or something that happened culturally or like is a famous ghost story?
No, I want one of yours.
Okay. so let's see here. I was staying with some friends that were in around Urbana-Champaign in Illinois, and it was a married couple, and the wife, who is still a very dear friend of mine, she has had many experiences as well with ghosts, and so they warned me coming in. They were like, "This place is haunted, just so you know." And I was like, "Okay." Okay, I'll tell you two stories. I'll make them short so that way I can squeeze in two.
Okay.
So this one, she warned me that it was haunted, and I was like, yeah, whatever. I've dealt with this before. It can't be that bad. So I'm taking a shower in the middle of the day. I don't know why. I think I just got up really late, and I was lazy. And I was all alone in their apartment, and I had just gotten out of the shower, and I was drying off, and I could hear the answering machine making noises, and it sounded like someone was going through the messages. And like one starts playing and then it stops and then there's a beep and then another one starts playing, and then there's this one with this woman who's like, my friend, I miss you, I miss you, I love you. And I'm like, what is that? And so I'm like trapped in this bathroom because I'm like, oh my God, something is happening out there and I don't want to leave. I don't know what I'm going to do. And so that message stops and then it plays again.
Oh my God.
I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to leave this bathroom at some point. So like as I open the door, the answering machine stops. And so when my friends come back, I tell them the story and they play the answering machine messages and all of them are there except for that one woman. And they tell me it's the anniversary of one of their good friends that had died, and that maybe it was that person.
Oh my God, I'm all like chills.
So that's one that happened to me. So I love ghost tours more than anything because they're basically history tours with ghosts sprinkled in. And the best one I ever went to was in New Orleans. And I was like a freshman in college. And so if you call a hotel in New Orleans and you ask if it's haunted, they have to tell you. And I know that because my roommate called the Andrew Jackson Hotel. And they said yes. And I was like, we're not staying there. So we went on a ghost tour when we went, and one of the stops was the hotel. And they told us the story. So basically, this place had been an old, like, boarding school, and it burned to the ground and killed all the kids, which is really sad. But now it's haunted. And so the kids, they think it's the kids, because what will happen is things like phones will ring randomly. You know, New Orleans is really muggy hot, and people will come into their rooms and the heat has been turned on to like 90 degrees. There was evidently stories of like people, this was back in the day, aging us here, but yeah. It was with, you know, your film cameras, they would get the film developed and find photographs of them sleeping. It was kind of, I was like, I'm both extremely delighted to be on the tour and also so grateful to be here.
Yeah. Well, and especially if you are somebody who's prone to those experiences, it means you're going to experience it.
Yes.
Because some people who just are so, like, don't believe it, are so closed off, they just probably won't experience it.
Yes. I listened to podcast Science Versus, and they were exploring ghosts, and I was just like, you know, I turned to my husband, I was like, I just want you to know it's accurate. Like, ghosts are real, and I know that science doesn't say it, but whatever. There's that movie Before Sunrise.
Yeah.
And they talk about how, like, you have to, maybe it was Before Sunset, but you have to believe one little bit of magic in the world. So yeah. Mine is ghosts.
I believe in that magic too. Like, I just hope there's something, you know, I want there to be something more than this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think for me, like, I'm not necessarily religious or anything like that, but if I had to be, I would like believe in like ideas of like reincarnation or Buddhism, and this idea that like, you know, we return or, you know, that we're energy that doesn't just get destroyed, but are displaced or put somewhere else in some way. I've also told my husband that, you know, if I die first, I'll haunt him. And he's like, please don't do this.
Tell my husband that too. I said, oh, you know, like my grandmother said, look for me in pink. You know, I said to Greg, oh, I'll come up with something that you should look for. And he's like, no, thank you. Like, I'm like, come on. Yeah.
I'm like, I'll just slam the door. And he's like, please don't haunt me,
please. Well, it was so funny. This isn't funny. When Charlie was really little, our neighbor, who was my age, passed away really suddenly. She had ovarian cancer and didn't realize till she was stage 4 and died very quickly. It was really sad. And Charlie, maybe a year and a half later after she'd passed, he said, you know, where is she? Because I remember there was a mommy that lived there, and now she's not there. And I said, oh, well, you know, she died. And we'd never really talked to him about heaven or any, like, what happens when people die, and, you know. And Greg was away on business. Charlie was a super smart little kid. We ended up talking for like 3 hours. And I just kept going, and I'm like, well, some people believe in this, and some people believe in that, and some people believe in reincarnation. And he loved that. He's like, what's that about? And I'm like, well, that you come back. And so anyway, Greg gets home from his trip, and I'm in the kitchen, and they're in the other room, and hey, Greg comes, he's like, how does our 3-year-old know about reincarnation? And I was like, well, there was a conversation that went a little off the rails. And anyway, he really liked it. And when he was about 5, he goes, I think, Mommy, when I die, I'm going to ask the angels if I can come back as a snowy owl. And I'm going to see if maybe you can come back as my snowy owl mom.
Oh.
Isn't that the sweetest thing ever?
That's so cute.
But, you know, I just, like, whatever makes you feel better. Because, like we were saying before, it's coming. Like, it's the circle of life. So whatever can make you feel better leading up to that, you know, do it.
Yeah.
Wow, that was the biggest tangent in the history of Art for Your Ear. This is Ghosts for Your Ear. That'll be the new season. I'm keeping all of that in. That was awesome. But now I've had you on here for an hour and a half, and I'm going to let you go and eat the food that they have made for you at your residency.
Yes. I like to say that we're cattle, and the cowbell rings at 6:30, and we all come fight in to eat.
6:30? Oh, you've got like 5 minutes till it. Oh, no, it's late. Are we past that? Oh, we're half an hour past that.
It's 5 minutes till dinner. I'll be okay.
Okay, phew. This is going up this weekend. I'm going to do a gigantic post, and it's kind of timely. I mean, yesterday was Halloween, so this will be a few days after Halloween, so I'm going to make it work.
I think it will.
I think so too. Daisy, thank you so much. It was so nice to finally like put a person to the work that I've loved for so long and to get to know you a little bit, and you're just amazing, and good luck with everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much. You are just the warmest, most wonderful. I feel like there's this like don't meet your idols thing, but you're such a lovely person, and I so appreciate all of your support and your support for like other artists. I think that's, you're creating a community, and I think that's so important. I hate this cutthroat competitiveness.
Me too. I can't stand it. And I can't see an end in sight. I love this. Jealous curator forever.
Yay!
Okay, go enjoy your dinner, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. The not-so-speedy speed round might just have to turn into ghost story time instead. Ooh, I love that stuff so much. In fact, I loved everything about that conversation. Did you count how many times she said research? I was going to, but I didn't. So if you did, let me know. Put it in the comments. I love research too, and it just talking to her made me want to Google stuff right this very second. Thank you so much to Daisy for taking time away from her studio time at her amazing sounding residency to talk about MS and art and ghosts. Thanks to Saatchi Art and Thrive Mastermind for supporting this episode. And of course, thanks to you for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.